Think of the most technologically innovative companies of the last 50 years: Intel, Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter. Each one has a Silicon Valley address, and each one got backing from venture capitalists. Over the last decade, more than a third of the nation's venture capital has gone into Silicon Valley, and much of it has come from there as well. In our series on the history of Silicon Valley, NPR's Laura Seidel has this story on how venture capital and high tech grew up together.
When tech entrepreneurs go looking for money, they can easily end up here. University Avenue in downtown Palo Alto, with its clean brick sidewalks and high-end boutiques. Bill Reichert is a venture capitalist.
Within five blocks of here, there are probably between 30 and 40 venture capital firms. And there are probably also about 30 or 40 startup companies that have been funded by venture capital firms.
Reichert is a co-founder of Garage Technology Ventures. One of his firm's best investments was the streaming music service Pandora. In his third floor office, Reichert searches for another winner.
Hey.
Hi.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Of course.
This is a Silicon Valley ritual, the passionate young entrepreneur asking the venture capitalist for money.
So my name is Virginia Klausmar. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Silitex. So we have developed a fuel technology company.
This is Klausmar's third presentation to Garage Technology Ventures. She needs over $1 million to support the next phase of her clean diesel fuel.
Originally, you were going to make tankers full of your stuff.
Bill Reichert is trying to figure out if his firm should make an investment in her technology.
We see lots of brilliant innovations, any one of which could be economically exciting. But we're trying to pick the ones that are the most successful.
And if Reichert picks right, he can win big. He could bring back returns 20 times over for himself and his investors. He could find the next Facebook, Google, or Apple. As hard as it may be for an entrepreneur like Klausmar to get money, it used to be harder in the days before venture capital. In 1938, Bill Hewlett and David Packard used the bootstrap method. They started tinkering in a garage backed by $500 and a used drill press. It took a long time to build HP. The other method back in the day was know the right people. UC Davis professor Martin Kenny, a venture capital historian, says industrialists like Henry Ford and Andrew Carnegie asked friends and business contacts for money.
And you would go to that person and maybe have a business plan, but often not have a business plan, and explain your idea. And if you were properly socially connected, that was very important, that individual might put some money in your young firm.
The big change in how you could fund your company began here in Silicon Valley.
The origins of the modern venture capital industry, of connecting high-tech brains with money, took root here in the Valley in 1959.
Silicon Valley historian Leslie Berlin.
People were interested in the late 1950s in electronics. They didn't know how it worked, they didn't know what it did, but they thought it was going to be a big deal.
Back then, the area had the beginnings of a tech sector. William Shockley, who co-invented the transistor, had his lab here. Stanford University opened its industrial park, where companies like Lockheed, GE, and Hewlett-Packard had facilities. So three men decided to establish a firm in Palo Alto.
Specifically with a plan to invest in small technical companies.
The three men were retired World War II generals William Draper and Frederick Anderson and a former Ford Foundation president, Rowan Gaither. There was some venture capital on the East Coast, but DG&A set up a new kind of structure for investing that is widely seen as the precursor to today's venture capital firms. Here's how it works. The VCs go out and find new companies. The VCs match investors with new companies. The VCs get a cut of any profits, and key to the arrangement, the investors aren't liable for any legal problems at the startup. Draper, Gaither, and Anderson got $6 million worth of investment, says historian Leslie Berlin, and they had to find a place to put it.
People who worked at Draper, Gaither, Anderson would describe driving around to little companies and saying, basically, do you need any money? And they had a hard time finding people who were willing to take it because it sounded so shady. Wait a second, these people want to just give me money? Why?
But Draper, Gaither, and Anderson didn't do that well. It was another Silicon Valley firm that made venture capital the way to go.
There's no way that I know of, other than finding a gold mine, of making as much money as you can in technology.
Arthur Rock was the co-founder of the venture firm Davis & Rock in 1961. The firm hit it really big with an investment in Scientific Data Systems, or SDS, one of the first companies to use microchips in computers. Davis & Rock invested close to $260,000. 8 years later, Xerox purchased SDS for almost $1 billion. In 1968, Rock brought together the funding for another new company. Its name was Intel.
And it's probably the only company I ever invested in that I was 100% sure would work out.
Boy, were you right.
Yes, I was right on that one.
Venture capital firms popped up all over the area. It was soon dubbed Silicon Valley. Modern venture capital funding helped build Apple, eBay, Yahoo, Google, and Facebook. Perhaps those companies, or businesses like them, were destined to happen. But if their founders had to bootstrap it or get loans from a bank, it would have taken much longer. UC Davis professor Kenny says venture capitalists are more willing than banks to take a risk. And so the VCs sped up the pace of innovation.
And brought new technologies forward that may have come about, but certainly would have taken much longer. It also gave an opportunity to brilliant engineers and entrepreneurs to actualize their technological dreams.
Okay, so where are we at today? We are successfully in the validation phase.
Back in the third floor offices of Garage Technology Ventures in Palo Alto, Virginia Klausmeier is trying to sell her dream of making clean tech fuel developed by her late father.
He was the chemist behind the whole technology. He was my mentor, worked on
Klausmeier left her home in Oregon to start her company in Silicon Valley. She thinks if you are a young tech entrepreneur, this is the place to be, much the same way Hollywood draws young actors and filmmakers.
You know, you need to be around people that believe in you in many different levels, and this is the place. Everyone does believe that you can create change, you can make a big impact, and that you can do it in a short amount of time, and that it's going to be profitable, and they'll invest in you and make it happen, and it is just so inspirational.
While there are other contenders, Silicon Valley remains the premier destination for tech entrepreneurs with a dream. And as venture capitalists discovered decades ago, backing the right technology is like discovering a gold mine. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Tomorrow, how two Intel pioneers saved the company that would become the world's leading chip maker.
People in the tech world focus a lot on young entrepreneurs with fresh ideas, people like Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook or Jack Dorsey at Twitter. Today, in the final part of our series on the history of Silicon Valley, we're going to visit with some older leaders of that tech world. In a rare interview, two pioneers of Intel shared their story with NPR's Laura Seidel.
As Andy Grove enters the room, a wide smile crosses his face when he sees Gordon Moore.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
How often do you guys see each other?
Once a year.
The two men sit down beside each other in big, comfy chairs in the sunny offices of Moore's Foundation in Palo Alto. Moore is the co-founder of Intel, the most profitable silicon chip maker in the world, and his foundation is a retirement project. Grove is the legendary former CEO of Intel and its first hire. Big windows overlook a landscape of office parks where companies like Facebook got their start using technology these men helped make possible. Moore and Grove were a successful duo, but they're kind of an odd couple. Moore is a modest, introverted chemist.
I'm a loner.
That's true.
Grove, who is Jewish, survived Nazi occupation as a child and later fled communist Hungary. He arrived in the U.S. in 1957. He has a reputation for being a savvy businessman with a wry sense of humor.
I'm an older and creakier version of the same aggressive young engineer that Gordon hired.
That's right. Gordon Moore hired Andy Grove, first at a startup called Fairchild Semiconductor, right after Grove had finished his PhD in chemical engineering. For 5 years, they worked together at Fairchild. In 1968, Moore and another key executive there, Robert Noyce, decided to leave and start their own company. Moore told Grove about it.
And he said, I want to come too. That was about the length of the conversation.
I never got an offer. I should say, I never got an invitation.
You just said, oh, I'm leaving too.
The company Moore and Noyce founded was Intel, and it wasn't the only company competing in the chip industry. In 1968, computers were being used by most major businesses for payroll, accounting, and banking.
We got to the point where electronics were going into almost all consumer items, and So we had the feeling that this was the basic technology of some kind of a revolution.
Moore saw an opportunity for Intel in a relatively new area, putting computer memory or data storage on microchips. These chips would allow computers to be faster. In 1970, Andy Grove and Gordon Moore led Intel when it came out with the industry's first mega hit, low-cost memory on a chip. But developing that chip was tough. Grove puts head in hands when he thinks back to all the experiments.
Every pestilence that could kill a microchip hit it. We had no idea what we were doing. Key people standing around and testing all the chips on a wafer. Green light is good, red light is bad. Red, red, red. And we were a schlocky little outfit of 50 people.
I mean, how long did it take to sort of work through all this?
2 years. Seemed like 20.
For many years, Intel dominated the memory business. When the Japanese started making memory chips cheaper and better, few companies could compete. A lot of American memory chip companies went under. In 1985, that could have been Intel's fate.
The story was, we were sitting around in my cubicle, looking out the window, very sad. And I asked Gordon, you know, what would happen if somebody took us over, got rid of us? What would the new guy do? To which Gordon said,
get out of the memory business.
No, get rid of us. And get out of the memory business.
What Grove did next was radical. He changed Intel's direction completely. He closed the company's memory business, laid off 7,000 employees, almost a third of its workforce. He said it was agonizing to shut down plants.
We like to go to places where we'd be the only manufacturer. And when we pulled out, we left a hole.
Intel decided to beef up something that had been a side business. The company was also the inventor of the industry's first successful microprocessor. In the 70s, these could be found controlling elevators, traffic lights, garage door openers, and office printers. Microprocessors are the brains of a computer. These chips process everything from computation to multimedia displays on one chip. Intel went from making computers faster to making them smarter and cheaper. Ironically, Gordon Moore and Andy Grove, like many others, didn't see their biggest customer coming.
We were exposed to Apple's early products, and I could not imagine anything except trivial applications.
Such as?
To keep your recipes in the kitchen.
That's right, yeah. I had exactly the same feeling about it.
Yet the eventual rise of the personal computer fueled Intel's success. In the 1980s, then-CEO Andy Grove made some smart moves. There have been books and business school talks about Intel's twists and turns, but Grove's key move was his refusal to license Intel's new cutting-edge microprocessor. Intel would be its sole manufacturer. The company's success is the reason Andy Grove was Time's Man of the Year in 1997. But not all the talk about Intel has been good. The chipmaker has been the target of several antitrust suits. Intel's been forced to pay large settlements and fines and change some of its business practices, though Intel has not admitted any wrongdoing. What Grove emphasizes is that they were trying to create products of value and a company that would last. Today, Grove thinks a lot of Silicon Valley is all about quick profits. There are two words he hears that make him cringe.
Exit strategy. I hate it.
Grove says too many young techies and venture capitalists want to sell their companies or go public, get rich, and get out.
And I really don't have much respect for the people who live their lives motivated by an exit strategy existing and being performed. There was no option that we were trained in. If it gets too hard, get up and leave.
You didn't have that option. You were running a company that was losing money. You found a way to fix it.
And that took 10 years.
Nowadays, both Grove and Moore look around at the Silicon Valley they were very much a part of creating and lament that the devices designed here are not manufactured in the U.S., and they can talk. Intel does about 3/4 of its manufacturing here. Moore and Grove say they feel their biggest accomplishment is that in a fast-moving, competitive industry, their company has survived.
There have been 50 other startups, more or less, in the semiconductor industry. We're about the only ones still around.
Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
There's more of the conversation with Gordon Moore and Andy Grove at NPR.org, where you can also hear the rest of Laura's series on Silicon Valley.
We learned several days ago, thanks to an ACLU Freedom of Information Act suit, that local law enforcement is often tracking cell phones without court orders to do so. The New York Times, which looked at documents that the ACLU received, reported that cell phone tracking has become widespread and that it's also big business for cell phone companies. Well, now, Forbes magazine technology reporter Andy Greenberg has looked into that business. How much does a cell phone company charge for records of your cell phone's whereabouts? Well, Andy Greenberg joins us now from New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And how much do they charge?
Well, what's interesting is just how varied and complex these bills to law enforcement for data intercepts and wiretapping are. It's really just as complex as it is for you and I to pay our cell phone bill. There's a fee to intercept voice, but there's an extra fee for text messages and voicemail, for instance. So T-Mobile, for instance, charges a flat fee of $500 per target, and AT&T charges $325 activation fee plus this $5 per day for data and $10 for audio. It sounds quite a lot like it does when we pay our monthly bills.
Yeah, reach out and tap someone is what it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah.
If a cell phone company actually has a stated policy that it won't sell its customers' information to anyone, are they breaking that policy if they have this whole schedule of fees and there's no court order mandating surveillance?
Well, that's what's strange about the responses that I got from phone carriers. AT&T specifically pointed me towards their privacy policy when I asked about this and highlighted one sentence that says, "We do not sell your information to anyone, period." And when I brought this up to the ACLU, they said that's clearly misleading. I mean, what is the definition of sell? I mean, these companies are, in fact, handing over your data to a third party, law enforcement in this case, for a fee. So does that sound like selling your data to you? It sounds quite a lot like it to me.
Did AT&T tell you how they reconcile what they're doing with their policy?
AT&T was one of the most closed-mouthed companies that I asked about this. Sprint and Verizon both had slightly more detailed responses. Sprint, for instance, wanted to point out that it doesn't profit from this, but it does feel like it's legally required to comply.
Now, so far as you know and what you've gleaned from the ACLU, are we talking about a handful of terror suspects, serial murderers, kidnappers, or is this relatively widespread concerning lots of criminal suspects?
I think the vast majority of wiretappings are about drugs, the war on drugs. If you look at the last 10 years, there's been this vast increase in wiretaps, which are all reported. These are the ones that require warrants, and that's documented in a report from the courts that's submitted every year.
As you understand it, if a cell phone carrier were to say, no, you need a court order to do that, would law enforcement then just go to court and get warrants?
That's my understanding, but there are different kinds of these data requests. There are straightforward wiretaps for which law enforcement does seem to need a warrant, but then there are these things like pen registers and trap and trace, which simply look at the call logs, the numbers that someone is calling or who's calling them. Then there are things like checking text messages, and then perhaps the creepiest of all is location tracking. Mm-hmm. And for location tracking, there is no legal mandate for a warrant as yet.
What exactly is a tower dump? I gather that's a term of art here.
That's something that I first learned about through this FOIA request from the ACLU, and it's been described to me as a record of every call that's made and every call that's received through a certain tower, regardless of whether they're a suspect in a criminal investigation or not.
Is it clear to you, by the way, that this fee schedule that you were told about, that this is only for law enforcement, even without a warrant? Or, I mean, could the local daily newspaper or local TV newsroom decide that it wants to buy a tower dump or to track a particular cell phone?
That I really hope that that's not the case. That would be an enormous privacy scandal. But there is no indication from these documents that that's happening. I mean, these were very – I got this billing specifically from a Tucson, Arizona police department, and they're referring to this as a law enforcement request system, not something that Rupert Murdoch can call up Sprint and get thousands of people's phone records, thank God.
Well, thanks for talking with us about it.
Thanks so much.
It's a technology reporter, Andy Greenberg, of Forbes magazine.
This is NPR News. A new smartphone goes on sale today. The Nokia Lumia 900 represents the Finnish company's big and somewhat desperate effort to regain a toehold in the all-important U.S. market. NPR's Wendy Kaufman offers this brief history of America's infatuation with the mobile phone.
In the iconic 1987 film Wall Street, Michael Douglas strolls the beach with his cell phone and uses it to congratulate an associate on making a ton of money.
You've done good, but you got to keep doing good. I showed you how the game works. Now school's out.
The image gave the still novel gizmo a huge boost in popular culture. That same year, the mobile phone got another jolt into public consciousness, with cameras rolling in Helsinki, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev called Moscow. But while the late 1980s marked the beginning of our love affair with the mobile phone, its history traces back to the 1940s. AT&T first introduced the concept in St. Louis with just a single transmission tower. Only a few people could use their phones at the same time.
The phones were in cars.
That's Sheldon Hochheiser, an archivist at the IEEE History Center at Rutgers University. He knows a lot about those early phones.
They weighed 80 pounds and filled much of the trunk. Remember, these are before transistors. These are vacuum tubes.
For a long time, AT&T's phones were stuck in the car. On the other hand, Hochheiser says, Motorola had a different vision.
And it was Marty Cooper who conceives of the idea of a completely portable telephone that one can carry around with them. He demonstrates a prototype phone in 1973.
Cooper, then a vice president at Motorola, walked down a New York City street and called his competitor at AT&T.
And I told him, Joel, I'm calling you on a real cell phone, a personal, portable, handheld cell phone.
But regulatory and other hurdles loomed large, and in the U.S., more than a decade would pass before the phones would be commercially viable. And even then, they were pricey. An AT&T car phone would have set you back about $2,500. The Motorola model would have cost about $4,000. Improved technology would soon lead to smaller phones. Motorola's first one, designed to fit into a shirt pocket, made its debut in 1989. And Marty Cooper says Finnish phone maker Nokia was about to make the price shrink as well.
They worked out ways in which they could build a single phone and get big economies of scale, and they ended up with a very low-priced phone.
Back in the early days of the cell phone, experts predicted that about 900,000 Americans would be using the device by the turn of the century. They were wrong, very wrong. Historian Hochheiser says the number skyrocketed to more than 100 times that number.
The idea that the cell phone would become an everyman's device rather than something for extremely affluent people on the go clearly escaped almost everyone.
Today, about 300 million Americans have cell phones. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan. For more than a century, parents of deaf children had few options when it came to finding an education for their children. Most sent their kids to boarding schools for the deaf. Many of the children and the schools thrived in the shadows, embracing a distinct deaf culture. But recent advances in medicine and technology are now reshaping what it means to be deaf in America. Children who could never hear a sound are now adults who can hear everything. And that is having a dramatic impact on the nation's historic deaf schools, as well as on the lives of people like Shahzad Zaman. Zaman was born deaf 31 years ago to a family where everyone else could hear. His parents were worried. They wanted him to fit into a hearing world.
My parents wanted me to learn how to be able to listen and to be able to speak despite not being able to hear.
Zaman went to a special school for the deaf at first. But in third grade, his parents changed their mind. They sent him to therapy to teach him to read lips, and then they moved him to his neighborhood school in Long Island, New York. He learned to play sports and make friends, but it was never easy.
You know, all my peers were able to use a telephone and, you know, have conversations at noisy restaurants, and it was actually getting harder and harder for me to have a conversation outside of one-on-one or one-on-two.
But then, the summer before his senior year, a small miracle happened. A new piece of technology called a cochlear implant was helping deaf people hear. Doctors surgically inserted one into his ear. He woke up, and the world was an entirely new place.
At that time, I didn't know what I was hearing. You know, I was hearing so many different things that sounded so mechanical. And I was hearing the air conditioner or running water or the bird chirping, and I didn't know what it was. So it really took some time for my brain to really just process. You know, I would have to sit in the backyard as we try to absorb all the sounds.
More than half of all deaf children are now getting cochlear implants, and every year the number increases. One in four deaf adults also now have it, though it takes longer for adult brains to adapt to hearing sound. For Zaman, the decision to get an implant was practical as well as emotional. He wanted to go to med school, and he knew a doctor needed to hear.
In medicine, it's not acceptable to be able to hear 70% of the information, because that can make a difference in terms of the quality of patient care. So I was always trying to, you know, get up to 100% accuracy in terms of understanding the information.
Today, he's a physician in Sacramento, and last year he received a second cochlear implant in his other ear, which has brought his hearing to close to 100%. He says he no longer thinks about not being able to hear. Only in rare moments, when there's a lot of noise, does he search for someone's lips.
You know, we live in a hearing world, in a hearing society, you know, so it's really important to be able to hear. And I was just happy because, you know, I would be able to have much more ease in terms of communicating with people.
Zaman is already on his fourth upgrade of the device. And Dr. John Naparco, an ear specialist at Johns Hopkins Hospital, says there will be many more in the years ahead.
Just like our cell phones, our laptops are getting smaller, faster, smarter. Cochlear implants are becoming smarter in terms of bringing in the most important sound signals that are in the environment to the ear of the implant listener.
Experts say while they know that 1 in 1,000 children are born genetically deaf every year, it's almost impossible to track the rate of deafness over time. Hearing impairment is a spectrum, and it changes. So have its causes. Diseases like rubella, scarlet fever, and measles that have caused hearing loss have all but been eradicated by vaccines. But more premature babies with hearing loss are surviving. There also appears to be more children with autism, which has been linked to hearing difficulties. But what is certain is that more than half of the children who once were deaf, for whatever reason, can now hear. Dr. Naparco has performed hundreds of the surgeries.
Well, the cochlear implant's a remarkable technology that can take in sound waves, much like a hearing aid would. But instead of simply amplifying those sound waves and delivering them to the eardrum, what the cochlear implant does is to take that energy and translate it into an electrical code. That code is sent along a series of contacts which are placed directly next to the hearing nerve. And through microcurrent injections, through small packets of electricity, we can activate that hearing nerve, thus recreating the active hearing.
And will that work for most deaf people?
For the vast majority of deaf people, there is in fact a viable, vital hearing nerve that retains its responsiveness to this kind of stimulation.
If the majority of deaf cases can be treated by the cochlear implant, why doesn't everybody get one?
There remains, unfortunately, a socioeconomic divide with respect to access to cochlear implantation.
How much does it cost to get one?
The device itself is about $32,000. The hospital costs and surgery add another $10,000 to $12,000 on that.
So does insurance cover it?
Insurance generally does cover it, although there are some, unfortunately, some Medicaid programs now that have constrained access.
If parents have a child today that's born deaf, what can they expect in the years ahead? I mean, might their child become just fully integrated in mainstream society and even be just taken for a hearing person?
We fully expect that a child without other disabilities is in fact going to be fully mainstreamed within 3 to 5 years of receiving a cochlear implant.
Do you think that means that there will be a time in the future where deafness is a choice?
Well, I think we're already there, Laura. As individuals have learned more and more about this technology, they have learned that it wasn't developed as a referendum on deaf culture. It is a natural outgrowth of the technology boom that we have seen in our society over the past 30 years. But as technologies tend to evolve, cultures tend to evolve. And we may be seeing a new culture evolve that uses this technology, but still has foundations in the deaf world.
That's Dr. John Naparko from Johns Hopkins Hospital. For everything this technology has done for deaf people, it has created an uncertain future for deaf schools across the country. Dr. Richard Miyamoto is a former board member of the Indiana School for the Deaf.
Deaf kids have changed, so I think the schools are going to have to change.
More than 80% of children who are or were hearing impaired now attend their local schools. Just a couple decades ago, those kids attended deaf schools because there weren't any other options.
In the past, we really didn't have much to offer to deaf children, so they would automatically just be in the sign culture and would grow up that way, and that was comfortable for them. But when cochlear implants came along and there was something to be done for deaf children, many of them were successful, so they ended up living their lives in the hearing world rather than the deaf world.
Miyamoto says the drop in enrollment has led many deaf schools to rethink their mission.
What deaf schools have done is brought in many more complex kids with multiply handicapping situations, which are probably not part of their usual student population.
It's critical, however, that deaf schools adjust, Miyamoto says, not disappear.
Oh, I think there's clearly a place for the traditional deaf schools because not everyone does well with the current technology.
So this is like a fifth grade classroom. Let's just go in and take a look real quick at one.
Ed Basso opens the door to fifth grade at the Kendall Demonstration Elementary School on the campus of Gallaudet University, the nation's premier deaf college.
These tables are grouped in a semicircle right around the teacher's desk.
Basso heads the elementary and high school here. The desks in this classroom all face each other with the teacher at the head. Basso explains that this school is bilingual. It teaches in sign, but it also teaches English out loud. That's the way this school has always taught. But even he can sense change is coming. There are 265 students here.
How does that compare to decades past? More, less, about the same?
Oh, it's less. That's less. If you look at the history of schools for the deaf, there was a point in time where these schools were burgeoning because of the rubella bulge. I mean, at that time, rubella caused deafness. We didn't know it. The medications around it caused deafness. And so we had a huge group of students who were deaf because of that.
When was that?
Started in the 60s into the 70s, 80s.
At one point, the school had more than 500 students.
So now we have here one first grade, one second grade, one third grade, one fourth grade. Back then, we probably had two first grades or three first grades, three second grades, so there were more peers.
Then in 1975, Congress passed the Education for All Handicapped Children Act. It mandated all schools accommodate children with disabilities.
The law said kids should be, to the maximum extent appropriate, be educated in their home school with non-disabled peers. So people start there. And what often happens is kids fail their way into the deaf school.
These days, the school has found a niche helping students adjust to their implants before they leave for a traditional school.
Even a kid who's born and gets implanted, until that implant starts working, until they can listen to learn, they have to learn to listen. So while they're learning to listen, learning to use their device, they're missing a lot.
The school is also now reaching out to children with multiple disabilities in addition to hearing loss. One of the more common is autism.
We are seeing students that are having additional disabilities at our doorstep, and people need to know how to serve them. And so we're going to try and fill that gap and support people nationally in that.
If it sounds like Basso is navigating the issue delicately, he is. It's a touchy subject for some at the school, breaking from decades of tradition and history. But the change has already come. This year, one in five students have a second separate disability, in addition to not being able to hear. Stay with us on Weekends on All Things Considered.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later, we are going to hear more of your tweet poems. It's part of our Muses and Metaphor series for National Poetry Month, where we reached out via Twitter and asked you to send us tweet-length poems, and you are, and the poems are amazing. And you might have noticed that social media isn't just having an impact on poetry. It's changing the way we do a lot of things, including politics and other social activism. Sticking a pamphlet in each door has been replaced by email lists in a lot of places. Standing on the corner with one of those megaphone things has become Twitter. Petitions can easily be shared on Facebook instead of being taken from door to door or standing outside the supermarket. And thousands of people can organize for rallies and demonstrations in almost no time at all. And in some cases, stories that might have been overlooked by the mainstream media are kept alive by online activists, as in the Trayvon Martin case. We wanted to talk more about all this, so we've called upon Shelby Blakely. She's the journalist coordinator for the Tea Party Patriot. She's with us from time to time to talk about issues within the Tea Party. And also with us is Rashad Robinson, the director of the civil rights group ColorOfChange.org. Welcome to the program, both of you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to
Thanks
be back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Shelby, you have an interesting story, a personal story, about the way you feel that the kind of the online world of social media has kind of brought you into activism in a way you don't think would have been the case, say, 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, for me personally, I have small children, and I was a stay-at-home mom, and because of that, I wanted to get involved politically, but as I saw the Tea Party emerge, I couldn't start a group. I couldn't go to rallies because I was extremely limited in the amount that I could travel. So I found something that I could do within the scope of my responsibilities as a stay-at-home mother, and that happened to be journalism and researching and calling people and things like that and producing articles. And, you know, as everything progressed, I wound up becoming the journalist coordinator for Tea Party Patriots, and now I train other people with the experience that I've learned through my activism online.
Did you have to teach yourself this, or were these skills you already knew? You just didn't know how to use them in this way.
I'm self-taught as far as journalism goes. I've read journalist textbooks. I've attended classes, but a lot of the innate ability, such as interviewing, writing articles, you know, debating back and forth, and holding people accountable, those are skills I already had.
Well, and Rashad, to you, I mean, the Trayvon Martin story is the kind of thing that civil rights leaders would have been interested in anyway. And the whole question of how individuals are treated by, you know, police entities or law enforcement entities or quasi-law enforcement entities has long been a concern of civil rights activists. But you were saying, and we've been saying, that the Trayvon Martin story is the kind of story that might not have gone national without social media. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. I mean, every single day we're hit with all sorts of information on the radio or television or the news, and sometimes it makes us angry or inspired or upset. I think the power that we have through social media and through online advocacy in particular is that we can pair that information up with the ability to take action. So folks weren't just seeing information around Trayvon Martin on the news and becoming maybe outraged or upset, but they had the opportunity to take that moment where they had a feeling about what was happening and put it to action. And so there wasn't just one single leader doing work for the community, but people all around the country who had never met each other, of all races and backgrounds, could be their own individual activists, could sign petitions and share them online, could get people in their friend, family, and, you know, neighborhood network engaged in this issue. And so the ability of social media and the ability of online media really levels the playing field and gives, you know, people all around the country the ability to make their voices heard against much more powerful entities.
Do you think that the Trayvon Martin story, absent social media, might have stayed a local matter?
It absolutely may have stayed a local matter. You know, it's very hard to bring scale to these type of campaigns. You know, Color of Change has worked on a number of issues where they were local issues, but the ability to be able to tell a compelling story to that may have happened in Sanford, Florida, or New Orleans, Louisiana, and translate that story to people who may live in Seattle or Los Angeles or San Francisco, and to be able to help them sort of understand and make larger connections around systematic inequality you know, those type of opportunities didn't really exist before we had this ability to utilize technology. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't change the theory of change. It doesn't change sort of why we do this work, what we hope to achieve. It just gives us the ability to do it quicker and to build scale quicker.
And we're talking with Rashad Robinson of colorofchange.org. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, Shelby Blakely of the Tea Party Patriots. We're talking about the way online tools and social media are changing activism. Shelby, you know, one of the interesting things is you were telling us that you feel that a lot of the work that the Tea Party is doing is local. As you hear with Rashad, their sort of efforts, a lot of their efforts are to sort of nationalize kind of local issues and bring them into kind of a broader national narrative. What you're telling us is that the Tea Party actually you think has been more effective locally. Tell us a little bit more about why you think that is.
Well, the Tea Party is very diverse, and there's a lot of different work to be done. And a lot of the work of local coordinators and local groups is to find what people want to do and put them in the job they want and what they want to be good in. There's people who want to doorbell. There's people who want to do research. There's people who want to interview. There's people who want to get petitions signed. And there's really something for everything for everyone to do. But in regards to local races, there's people in the Tea Party who are interested in working at the state level, the local level, as well as the federal level. And because it is grassroots, because there is no clear leader, because it's not a top-down leader knows best mentality, it tends to be more encompassing and more diverse. So we do have a lot of elections on the local elections and activity on the local level, a school board here, a county commissioner here, a fire marshal there. And it's really members taking back their community and standing up and taking responsibility for the shape their community is in.
Shelby, do you ever worry, though, with some of these tools that, you know, there's a new phrase that a lot of people are using these days called dog whistle politics, where people are kind of using certain tropes or certain images to kind of get people stirred up, you know, hoping that they'll react, you know, viscerally and emotionally to something. Do you ever worry that with some of these tools, because there is a premium on speed and brevity, that sort of the nuance is getting lost, and perhaps some people get interested for the wrong reasons or because they feel a kind of an emotional connection that isn't really backed up by facts? Do you ever worry about that? And obviously, Rashad, I'm going to ask you the same question. But Shelby, you first.
There is definitely the potential for that. I mean, one of the reasons I got into journalism is because I would read news articles and I thought to myself, this contains about 25% of the information I need to make a rational decision. There's always huge chunks of information missing in these condensed stories. So you always, I guess they always want to, they want the reader to want more and read more. But, you know, you got to start giving us something that we can take and digest and some meat of the argument. And there is that danger. But then again, with speed, you trade with a dearth of information, you're going to gain some speed. And so I think it's really just a balancing act of which is more important to you at the time, getting one soundbite of information out, which has been going on for decades and which the American population has been trained to for decades. Or do you want to get the bigger, larger case out there and risk losing portions of your audience because they're not going to stay for the final chapters? Mm. It's really a balance and deciding what you need to achieve.
Rashad, what about you?
You know, hundreds, possibly even thousands of petitions are created every day, and so many of them fail, right? So many of them don't go anywhere, don't get signatures. The public is smarter than sometimes we give them credit for, and folks look at and examine it and read this information, decide what type of campaigns they want to be part of. At Color of Change, you know, we really research and look into sort of what we're putting out to our members, and our members really rely on us to walk them through the political process, to have a clear theory of change of why we're reaching out and why we're asking them to take action on a particular subject. And when our members are not with us, when they think that maybe this doesn't necessarily make sense or we should be going a different route or there should be a different target for the energy around a particular issue, they let us know.
Can you give an example?
You know, there was a lot of debate, you know, as we headed to the final days around fighting for justice for Troy Davis. Troy Davis was an inmate on death row who was executed September 21st. And Color of Change mobilized over 100,000 of our members over the course of a couple of years to fight for justice for Trayvon Martin. There were a lot of different theories around whether or not, you know, energy should be directed at the Georgia Board of Pardons, whether it should be directed at the Department of Justice, whether people should be directly calling the district attorney in Savannah, and everyday people who were on our list who we had worked to educate over the course of a couple of years were reading the news and making very clear decisions about what they wanted Color of Change to do. And they were letting us know every single day, you know, we think you should be going this route or we think we should be going this route. And we were working very closely with a number of coalition partners to help walk people through the process. But at the same time, you know, the goal of this work is to empower the voices of everyday people. You know, that is part of the mission statement of Color of Change, is to empower the voice of Black Americans. And so you just can't empower the voices if only thing you're asking people to do is click a button. Mm. You have to be able to listen to them and walk people through a process of not just signing petitions, but things, other things they can do once they've signed that petition to be involved in the process and to be engaged in the long term.
Okay, final thought. Final thought from you?
I totally agree. And it's about – the Tea Party is about education and providing tools to all Americans to facilitate the change they want to see in their community. SOPA was a great example of how speed was used to stop a horrible piece of legislation. And now we have CISPA coming up on the horizon,
for people who want to know.
CISPA is basically SOPA copied and pasted under the guise of Homeland Security or cybersecurity, but it's a very vague bill. It's really just a horrible bill. It's another attempt for the government to control the internet.
Okay. Well, we'll have to follow up on that. Shelby Blakely is the journalist coordinator for the Tea Party Patriots. She was with us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Also with us, Rashad Robinson, director of the civil rights group ColorOfChange.org. He was with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.